Recorded live in front of a Winter Garden audience in Auckland, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Season 4, episode number 15 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin. Hello! And joining me here at Auckland's wonderful, palatial, amazing Civic Theatre is...
Kaylee, and a glass of wine.
Hey,
finally get
well,
to drink, yeah!
Well set up. Big round of applause for Kaylee. This is fantastic. What an amazing feeling this is to be here on stage at the Civic Theatre, the
Mighty Civic. Look at all these good-looking people who are here to hang out.
In today's episode, longtime friend of Cinematica, Rudy Tavares, is going to review Behind the Candelabra for us. We're going to interview Curtis Vowell and Sophie Henderson from the New Zealand feature Fantail a little bit later on. Shirley Horrocks, the director of the documentary Venus, A Quest, is going to be joining us a little bit later on. And we're also going to be meeting the people behind flix.co.nz. So I want to apologise to regular listeners of the show that only two-thirds of the hosting team are with us here in Auckland for the show. Simon has been tied up by work commitments, and I know that he'll be listening to the finished version of this podcast, and I'm going to let him know now that he's really going to have to redecorate his office, because this is an easily a way a better environment to be doing the show, and I have to say. So, Si, you're missing out on this fantastic Civic experience. And, yes, sitting in Simon's office listening to the rain thunder down on the tin roof is going to be definitely a backward step. So, for those of you that... haven't listened to the show before, I know that we've got a lot of people in the audience who are regular listeners, but for those of you that haven't listened to the show before, we will start off with a little bit of a rundown of the New Zealand box office so that we can get a sense of what the Kiwi audiences have been going to. We know it's been the first weekend for the New Zealand International Film Festival in Auckland this weekend, so that would have dampened things down a wee bit in the commercial cinema. But Kaylee, can you give us a top five, please?
Yes, and it's also still school holidays, so things are a bit squiffy. So opening
squiffy, that's a technical term in the industry, I should point out.
So opening at number five this week, The World's End. At number four, down from three, The Heat. Number three, down from two, Pacific Rim. Two, up from four, Monsters University. And in the number one spot, Despicable Me 2.
Okay, so there are quite a few seriously troubling entries in that list. First of all, The World's End...
is the best film ever.
Just
going to put that out there.
Listeners to last week's show will know that that's exactly what we said. But only in at number five, still stuck there behind The Heat, which is not the best film ever. The Conjuring, which opened last weekend and in the US has just gone absolute gangbusters in terms of box office. Is that made it into our list?
Is it number six?
Number six. Okay, so maybe that'll pick up as time goes on. But yeah, interesting. Obviously, school holidays and those kids' movies still doing the business. But we haven't yet reviewed The Heat on the show. Usually, we
has anybody here seen The Heat? No. Okay.
So we can't blame any of you guys for its position at number four in the list.
It's a film and it happened and it's open.
We'll get round to it
if you want.
Yeah, that's right. We will get round to it, but when all this wonderful festival goodness is over, no doubt. So it's time to do our first review of the evening, and we're going to talk about the gala opening night film. That sound was me getting a message from one of our guests to say he's on his way. Yes, on Thursday night, the opening night film for the New Zealand International Film Festival in Auckland was this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Liberace.
This is my friend, Scott Thorson. You are incredible out there.
Well, this must be fate. I have a great idea. Why don't you come work for me?
As what?
Michael Douglas and Matt Damon behind the candelabra, Steven Soderbergh's. What he's threatening will be his final film as a director. He's been threatening to retire for some time. And so this may be the last chance to see any of his work on the big screen. We're joined in the palatial Cinematica studio by friend of Cinematica, Rudy Tavares, who we've been trying to get on this show for well over a year, and we finally managed it. And Rudy, you were sitting next to me on Thursday night for Behind the Candelabra. What is he's taken notes, ladies and gentlemen. I'm deeply impressed by that.
Hi, everybody. First, I did some notes for the review just to keep remembering everything. Yeah.
Excellent. I'm going to shut up now. You're doing all the work for me.
The gala was amazing. Yeah, the Civic, I think it's great theatre. Yeah, I'm a big fan of theatre, and I think it's great, massive venue, you know, and for everything. So
flamingos on the fire curtain. Fantastic.
Yeah, I was actually asking Dan. I was like, you think this setup, you know, this sort of the decoration according to Liberace, because I feel like 1975 in Vegas in a show with the flamingos and roses and...
No, but, that's just the Civic.
But just like fake roses, you know, like they've been there for 35 years. But anyway, just asking.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to apologize for my adorable broken English, because obviously it's not my first language, but...
Better than mine is usually, but anyway...
But I don't know if you guys have anyone else on board here that is not an English speaker. Well, I'm the first one.
I think you are the first. We've had some guests. We've interviewed some filmmakers in the past. There was one Italian filmmaker who we interviewed through his personal assistant, who was a translator. That was interesting. I think you're the first reviewer, the first guest reviewer with English as a second language.
Just to write it out on my Wikipedia profile, that's it. All right, Behind the Candelabra, well, I think it was, it's talk about the Liberace and Scotty, his lovely boyfriend. I think it was like pretty much, he was like the one who last, I don't know if he was the last the most.
He did go through them, didn't he? He used them up and spat them out, his sort of live-in lovers, boyfriends, personal assistants, chauffeurs. He sort of Scott, who wrote the book that the film is based on, played by Matt Damon, did seem to be the closest thing to the great love of Liberace's life.
Yeah, so this movie talks about this 6 year or 7 years relationship between them, and it pretty much summarizes everything, you know, like maybe not the relevant points, but mostly, you know, the most interesting spots about their relationship.
The most salacious and the most entertaining aspects of his life.
Yeah, so as Dan said, the film was made by Steven Soderbergh, is that? Yeah.
Yep.
Which is, you know, everybody seen Ocean's 11 and all the stuff, so... So the film is, you know, based in Vegas, late 70s, you know, where everything was fabulous and, well, Vegas is always fabulous, but in the 70s, I think it was even better, but, you know, all the shows and all the stuff, and I think the movie, you know, it did the best. It was a small budget, 23 million, I think it was, and they shoot it for like 30 days, so 30 plus days, and, thanks to, I think the acting was really good as well. Michael Douglas nailed it, I think. So I can't think anyone else will perform as a Liberace.
It seemed to me that he wasn't doing what a lesser actor would have done, which is just an impersonation of Liberace. I don't think he got every sort of timbre of the voice perfectly correct, but what he did get was the character, and I think that's the most important thing. You got some truth about the character rather than being able to close your eyes and believe that it was Liberace. I got a question. I don't know if anybody knows this from the audience who saw Behind the Candelabra, but how did they do the piano playing? Because I'm pretty sure Michael Douglas isn't phenomenally gifted keyboardist as well as all the other things he could do, but I just, you have the answer.
Yeah, I don't want to talk much about the movie because I don't want to spoil Kelly or anyone who haven't seen it. But I have some notes about pieces of useless information about the movie that I found.
Trivia is awesome.
Yeah, good for trivia, like behind the candelabra, trivia night, something.
We
like
live
that.
For trivia here.
He actually learned. He used to play when he was growing up, Michael Douglas, but of course not like him, but. So he had to sort of, train some tricks when the camera was on point of him, but he didn't invest in much time. He didn't put much effort on it. It is actually more about the playing with the camera than actually his playing. But yeah, he's done some tricks. That's it.
Something that I thought of in that opening sequence where we introduced to Liberace and Scott sees him on stage for the first time, I think there's something really interesting about realizing that. For all of the cliches that we think of in terms of Liberace, for the campness, the fact that he's become a bit of a historical joke, the fact is that he was a fantastic entertainer. He was, it was no accident that he achieved what he achieved in terms of his success and being able to play all those shows at Vegas and being able to make all that money, of which, of course, he's in. In the film, he's inordinately proud of. But it's always good to be reminded that actually, these people may be caricatures to us now, but actually, there was a core of talent to them. He really did know how to put on a show.
Yeah, yeah, true. Like, I think it's, like anyone who's been in Vegas, shows are what it's made for. You need to go to those places and enjoy the shows, but. Just another notes that I took there. So this movie, it's been in talking since 2000. So Steven, I think they found that he was interested to do something about Liberace because he sort of grew up. He says in this interview that I read from a UK magazine, I can't remember. Maybe it wasn't true, but I'm sorry.
You never give away your sources. You found it. You found the interview yourself. You did the interview yourself. Cool, blimey.
Anyway, so he said that when he was growing up, his parents were very conservative, so he was not allowed to, they never enjoy a show. I think Liberace had this TV show, I can't remember the name, but it was on show like once a week or something like that. So they were not allowed to watch it, and that's why he was a bit interested to do something about him. And while filming Traffic, He brought the idea to Michael Douglas and he was very excited as well. He's like, yeah, let's do it. But they couldn't find anything to, he didn't want to do the classic, biographer movie. So until they pop up with this.
I have to say that for all of his fears that he didn't want to do a sort of classic cliched biography movie, that's sort of what it's ended up being. Like the script itself, if it wasn't in the hands of Soderbergh, who not only directed it but also shot the film and edited the film, and with that class that he brings to the actual execution of it, it could easily, that script in the hands of somebody with lesser talent could have ended up just being a sort of Sunday night movie, I think. That was my feeling walking out, that it was like elevated television. Oh, I'm going to use that.
I remember you saying that. I don't think so. I think the movie, like everything in the movie, was click into each to each part of it. That's my point of view. I mean, it's only $23 million budget.
Yeah. But wasn't it made for HBO? So it is elevated television.
Yeah, HBO is elevated television by its very nature. But yes, that's right. But it did. It certainly belonged on the big screen. There was no question about that. And I think that it's still got screenings to go around the New Zealand International Film Festival, and there will be opportunities for people around the country to see it on the big screen, which I'm sure they should. So, Rudy, I'm just going to ask you to wrap up now with, again, this is for people who are unfamiliar with the show. We like to basically reduce high quality art down to basically the most sort of ridiculous level possible. So I'm going to ask you to sum up the film in two words.
Fabulous melody.
Nice work, Rudy. My elevated television is my summary, my two-word review of Behind the Candelabra. So can you please put your hands together, please, for Rudy Tavares. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dan, Kelly. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks. I'm so glad we finally got you on the show.
Please put your hands together for flix.co.nz's representatives here tonight, Steve and Liam. Now, you've been doing an absolutely sterling job of monitoring and tracking the New Zealand International Film Festival for people. You've been giving people preview advice. You've been going to see films. You're tweeting away furiously. You're just doing a fantastic job. I want to ask you, before we get into your picks for the festival, just a little bit, tell us a little bit about Flix, where it came from, and what people, you know, there may be some people in the audience who are unfamiliar with the site and don't use it on a daily basis like normal, sane, rational people should do.
That's a fantastic introduction. Thanks very much, Dan. my name's Steve. I'm the editor and manager of Flix. It's not very often that I'm eyeballing people who use the site face-to-face, so it's quite a unique opportunity to be here. I've been at Flix for just over a year. The site's been around for a bit longer than that. It sort of emerged in the mid-2000s, if anyone remembers back then, with the unique idea that you could put movie times on the internet, and you know, no one had really tried to do that before. It took a while for Flix to turn around the idea from distributors that that's just stuff you put in the paper, but I think it's pretty fair to say that that's probably quite a minute way that people find out about films now.
Well, it's got to the point now where 5 days out of seven, most movie theatres will put an ad in the paper saying, well, they haven't quite got to the point of just like go to Flix, which is probably what they should do, but they are saying check the website for times. There, you know, it used to be the big directories that people would go to, and they would check, you know, morning tea time. They'd open up the paper and see what they were going to go and see. In the evening. Now they check your site or your app, which I must admit is probably my most used app on my phone. I'm just constantly using the data on the app to check what I should be going to, where I should be. Because I watch a lot of movies, right? So I need to know, you know, if a film's playing at three different locations in Wellington, which one's closest to me, which one's got the next showtime. So, fantastic app that you guys run as well.
Cheers. There's a few facets to the Flix that have kind of evolved over time from that basic idea. You can look at the desktop site. There's the app, obviously, on iPhone and Android. There's a mobile site. Basically, all the stuff that we do sort of underpins the idea that we want to help people choose their movie, and so that's finding out, I guess, information about a film so they can evaluate their movie choices. They can find the session times to see it. And there's a whole bunch of sort of editorial stuff that we do to support that as well. So things like the International Film Festival that's on at the moment gives us a chance to kind of put a flag in the ground about stuff that we think people should be seeing. And, you know, gives us a good excuse to talk to directors and filmmakers around that as well.
Liam, So you were gazing off into the distance there for a moment. I thought I'd draw you into the conversation.
Well, he was just doing it so well. I mean, I can't really add anything else to it.
I was just going to ask you, what role do you play with in the giant Flix organisation?
Well, I've been part of Flix for slightly, I think, 1 month longer than Steve has, which when the original editor, Andrew Headley, left, I thought, yeah, this is my chance. I'm going to be the editor of Flix in just under a month. But then I was introduced to this tall, confident, good-looking son of a bitch, and I realized that was just not going to happen. And so I'm pretty much Steve's sidearm now.
I actually didn't realize that this was the situation.
Awkward.
And now it's very awkward, and I've kind of wondered why I felt like there were crosshairs on my back for the last 12 months or so.
Yeah, but you don't want to be at the top of the stairs together, do you, really?
Hell no. Single file might be worse, actually.
I leave the office first, so he's safe for now.
So you've both been going to see lots of festival films. First weekend of the International Film Festival in Auckland. What have your highlights been so far? Maybe Liam first.
Yeah, yesterday I saw Mud, which if anyone knows me, knows that I am totally in love with Jeff Nichols' work. He did Take Shelter, which I think played at the film festival 2 years ago, which I only just caught, and I fell in love with that. And I also fell in love with Shotgun Stories. And I think Mud it's probably rare to say this, but I think that should be adapted into a novel, because it's such a dense coming of ager, which I suppose that would be a two-word review right there. And it's kind of surprising that it all just came from his mind and not from another literary work. It's fantastic. You should go see it.
I've heard great many things about Mud, and I can't wait to see it when it gets to Wellington. Steve, what about you?
I might just throw a question back to Liam for a second first.
Oh, well, yes, sure, just take over.
Which is, how does Mud fit into your Matthew McConaughey's only good when he wears a cowboy hat theory?
I'll have to revise that, because it's now turned into if he wears a cowboy hat or if he shows up shirtless throughout any part of the movie, which he certainly does.
But doesn't he show up shirtless in every one of his films? I think you're going to have to add some
filter. I'll have to revise this once again.
Well, I'm looking forward to the fruits of your research on that particular topic.
That's what they pay me for.
I'd like to see a visual chart as well. I think that would be helpful.
Of Matthew McConaughey's chest, or
no. Of charting his work, and based on, you know, hair, what he's wearing.
Okay, I'll get a grant for that.
Cool. Yeah.
Indeed, Steve. What's been your highlight of the weekend? The first weekend.
It's always tempting to kind of rush out of the gates at the film festival and try and do too much in the weekend. So I took a bit of a tempered approach and only saw a film a day, which I think for film lovers is doing it easy. But
part-timer.
For Joe Public, it's like, oh, movie every day. It's a bit hard, actually. I only saw one thing that disappointed me over the weekend, so everything else is kind of at the top tier. Lots of catalogue or reissued films really did it for me this weekend. North by Northwest looked fantastic in the 4K version at the Civic. Weekend of a Champion, the Roman Polanski, Jackie Stewart documentary I saw with my dad last night, which is the third year in a row we've gone to see movies about motorsport together. So that's good work, Bill Gosden, for helping us bond as father and son. That's actually a really good doco. That's probably the one I'll single out, actually. It's a really good sort of personal spotlight about Stewart at the 1971 Grand Prix in Monaco. And Polanski and him are mates. They're just kind of hanging out together. And it's lots of handheld camera work. It's very much of its era. So the haircuts are great, the clothes are great, the cars are great, the babes are great, the wallpaper's great. And it's just kind of insightful, I guess, about what it's like to be a Formula One champion. And he talks a lot about how he drives and life and stuff. And then they catch up at the end in the present day and kind of recap some of it.
I was talking to Bill about that earlier on today, actually, because, you know, obviously hugely disappointed that no screenings of that film in Wellington. And he said that the distributors have what he loosely described as a strategy around the Southern Hemisphere, which was two festival screenings only, Auckland and Melbourne. That's it. And they're kind of hoping that it will then get picked up by distribution, but you know, it's a pretty focused sort of audience for that.
It's a very specific strategy. Yeah. I didn't actually see many familiar faces going into the theatre last night as well, so it may be the case that it's actually kind of just bypassed a whole bunch of media types and, you know, the sort of people you normally see at screenings like this. So maybe a backfire there.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting, and yeah, obviously hugely disappointing for those of us that love motorsport. Yeah, Kaylee, big Formula One fan, and very sad face. People,
that's not a joke. I do love Formula One. It's true.
Right. Now, hopefully we've timed this correctly so you guys can help us out with the next segment of the show, which is where we look at the film news for the week.
So ridiculously loud. San Diego Comic-Con came and went at the weekend with some big news coming out of both DC and Marvel Studios. DC and Warner's went first by announcing that the next film to feature Superman will also mean sharing the screen with Batman, directed by Man of Steel's Zack Snyder. Warner's sees this as a staging post on the way to the anticipated Justice League of America movie, which they hope will do for them what the Avengers did for Marvel and Disney. Thoughts?
Now, I don't know about you guys, but this seems like the worst thing in the world, doesn't it? Like, Zack Snyder, Superman, and then let's just drag Batman into this mix. I'm just appalled, frankly.
I actually think the worst idea would be if Joel Schumacher and Bryan Singer held hands and decided to take over the reins to make Batman and Superman.
Okay, so it could be even worse. So you're a Snyder fan, Liam?
fan might be a strong word, but I didn't mind his vision for Man of Steel.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, maybe it's just me. Anybody in the audience, should we take a little vote on whether we think that this is like a really thumbs down, yeah, lots of thumbs down. Okay,
lots
so
of thumbs down.
So Warners and DC,
one thumbs up.
Pay attention to the Cinematica audience, ladies and gentlemen.
I want to go cautiously positive, actually, just against the grain as usual. I really like that Batman's been kind of freed from the grasp of the Nolan grimy gritty and is being returned back to just a more kind of pulpy potential, I think. So I, for one, am sick of the grounded in reality superhero, and I think it's done and it's boring. So.
Okay, well, we shall see soon enough.
Yes, and then Marvel stole some of DC's thunder shortly afterwards when Avengers director Joss Whedon revealed that the next Avengers movie is going to be called Age of Ultron.
Yeah, and I read that.
I'm just excited it'll be Joss Whedon.
Age of Ultron, I read that and thought, are they setting it in a petrol station? Like, what? I'm unfamiliar with the oeuvre. Is Ultron a character that I should be aware of?
Well, this comes from my brother who was telling me this last night, actually. And I could be completely wrong, in which case he's completely wrong, so I'm not going to be blamed for this. But apparently, Ultron was Ant-Man's creation. Ant-Man that's going to come out in 2014 by Edgar Wright. And Ultron was this robot who pretty much thought, you know what, humanity, the flaws outweigh the cons, so I'm just going to wipe them out. I mean, we've heard that before, but, you know, it's in comic books, so it sort of has a home there.
Okay, so there was some even later breaking news that arrived while I was typing up the script for today. Apparently the movie, the Batman-Superman movie, is going to be called Batman versus Superman.
I take back my previous positivity.
Is it going to be like Mortal Kombat? It's like, fight!
I got the feeling this weekend as all this news sort of to come out of Comic-Con and the amount of money that these films cost to make and the amount of money that these films take back at the box office, it seemed to me that we were watching the birth of or the split of an art form into two completely separate things, and the comic book blockbuster big screen movie is just going to go off into its own separate world and will have to be judged entirely on its own terms. And the rest of movies are going to just be sensible back over here somewhere. It just seems to me that sometime around 2014 or 2015, when's Ant-Man? Is that 2015? 2014. You're allowed to talk to me. It's a conversation.
I was giving you the cue.
But it seems to me that every weekend for maybe 6 months in the middle of each year, it's just going to be superhero movie after superhero movie after superhero movie. And we should, you know, as a film reviewer, I sort of feel like I should just send somebody else off to do those, and we should just treat that as a separate art form entirely.
Rudy's volunteering.
It's interesting to look at Comic-Con, which is still this kind of big celebration of geek culture, or that's what it sort of is still positioned as. The people that go to it have a great time. The media that cover it have a great time, but no one's really examined sort of what you're driving at, really, which is the commodification of that kind of audience. And with all those big studios in that sandpit, and they're basically starting to just apply their traditional techniques, like throw lots of money at it, have big parties, have big events, do things on a big scale, it's probably about time that some questions started being posed about it, whether it's positive or negative.
The highlight of Comic-Con in terms of what I saw was there were a couple of things involving Michael Fassbender, who was there for the X-Men presentation. In fact, they got all of the cast of X-Men for their big presentation. And apparently he turned up wearing the Your Next mask, which, you know, Your Next being a film that's playing in this festival, low-budget horror movie, cult movie. This is a sign that, you know, maybe that's crossing over into sort of mainstream consciousness. And apparently he, like a lot of the other celebrities at Comic-Con, used that mask as a way of getting around the convention without being recognised.
Speaking of that, Bryan Cranston did that by wearing a mask of his own face.
I saw the pictures of that. That was incredible. And my other great Fassbender story was apparently he got absolutely trolleyed at the Entertainment Weekly party and had... You know, best time?
This is sounding super positive for when he comes to the South Island to shoot later this year.
Yes, I was just about to mention that. A friend of mine has just auditioned for that. A Western, ladies and gentlemen, with Michael Fassbender being shot
in
Otago.
Have you told Rebecca at the film festival yet?
No, I haven't, but she will be listening to the show. I imagine she's just chucked this episode on pause and is already already driving down to the South Island, camping out. Yes, very exciting news. But that's all I've heard, though. Do you know more than I?
That's pretty much all I know. He's teaming with a British director who's he's made a couple of short films with previously. One's called Pitch Black Heist, which you can track down online and watch, which is pretty cool. That's pretty much all I know. The director used to be in a band I like called the Beta Band.
So you have done a little bit of research, which is admirable.
I ran into the right people when I was stuck in Wellington the other weekend.
Right.
Excellent. In sad news, character actor Dennis Farina passed away suddenly last night at the age of 69. A former cop, he served for 18 years in the burglary division of Chicago Police Department. Farina became a full-time actor in 1985. He often played cops or mob bosses and was especially memorable in films like Manhunter, Midnight Run, and Get Shorty.
Yeah, Midnight Run, one of the all-time great films. It's like, if you haven't seen Midnight Run, seek it out and add it to the collection, because it was just one of the best De Niro films ever. Charles Grodin and of course Dennis Farina as well. You guys seen it, Midnight Run?
I have to seek it out and add it to my collection.
You do. Absolutely. I'm ordering you to.
Is it just me or has Dennis Farina been old forever?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, those of us with a little bit of grey in our hair have been suffering that that accusation for a while.
Excellent. And Dan and I will be back in these chairs next Tuesday as we are hosting the special filmmaker Q&A for Romeo and Juliet, a love song, which is awesome. Please go see it. It is hilarious and fantastic and amazing. That's here at the Winter Garden Tuesday after the 1 p.m. screening of the film.
It's been really interesting talking to people about Romeo and Juliet, a love song, because if you haven't seen it, people who've read the festival program, I think, are finding it sort of really unpromising. You know, like it's Shakespeare, they think it's going to be worthy. The idea of updating it and setting it in a New Zealand caravan park. I've talked to a number of people who've just gone, oh, really? Or that sounds like it'll just be hard work. I can tell you now that it is fantastic.
There are guitar solos, there are explosions, there are stabbings, there's rapping.
It's like no film that has ever been made in this country before and probably ever will again. And, I can't recommend it highly enough for an amazing campy night out. It's one of those films I reckon that the only way it doesn't bode well for the box office when it gets released later on this year is that the only way to get people to it is to sort of shake them by the lapels and make them go. we'll be here next Tuesday back here to talk to the filmmakers about that and pat them on the back.
Mm.
So that's our news. Thanks very much to flix.co.nz, Steve and Liam, for helping us out. And let's give them a big, generous Winter Garden round of applause.
Cheers, folks.
Thank you.
You're not a Maori, but you speak like one.
I am Maori.
Well, no, you're not. You've got blonde hair and blue eyes.
I'm Ngāti Whātua.
Look, Tanya, pretending to be Maori offends them. And me.
You are Māori.
Not really.
Your last name's Henare.
Okay. Do you speak Māori or do you just do the voice?
My brother got all the Māori genes. You should see him. He looks like you. Brown as.
Yep.
Fantail is a New Zealand feature that is going to be playing a little bit later on in the Auckland branch of the New Zealand International Film Festival and also in Wellington. And joining us here on the stage, Sophie Henderson and Curtis Val. And so let's give them a big round of applause.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
When I was typing up my review of the film, I did what I always do, and that is I auteur things. And so it's like the director's so-and-so. So it's Curtis Vowell's so-and-so. And I got halfway through typing it and thought, well, it doesn't seem very fair, does it, really, seeing as, Sophie, you wrote the script and you star in it. And so if there was some way of like sharing the auteur credit for this film, that would be the way I would have to do it. Is that a fair comment?
He can have it if he wants.
No, that's a very fair comment. I would absolutely share the credit with Sophie. It's been very much a team effort right from the start. So, the film wouldn't be around without Sophie. And I just played my part in directing it. So, yeah.
You just ordered people around on set?
Yeah, I suppose that's the job of the director. So.
Eat some sandwiches and catering.
Yeah, exactly. Sophie and I married, so... right from the early development stage, I have been involved, but the film's really growing together, would you say, Soph?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aww. Compulsory collaboration at home.
Yeah, 24/7, non-stop. It's just been our lives for the last 2 years. So.
We're both then equally obsessed with it. Yeah.
So, Sophie, tell us where the idea came from and maybe... At the same time, you can help the audience out who maybe haven't read the program notes, so you can give them a little bit of a background as to what the film's about.
Sure. I wrote a solo piece when I was at drama school in 2006. It was just a 10-minute, one-woman piece about this girl, Tanya, who thinks she's Māori and is working in a petrol station to save money to take her little brother to Surfer's Paradise to find their dad. And I was inspired by working in retail, which I had done a solid 8 years of. And also I went to primary school for a bit in Whangarei, where I was one of the few Pākehā kids in my class. And I remember learning about Māori myths and legends and te reo and making plastic bag poi and being part of Kapahaka. And when you're little, you kind of think, oh, yeah, I'm from New Zealand, that's my culture too. And I guess it was about me realising that maybe it wasn't my culture. And I sort of thought, what would happen if a Pākehā girl truly thought that she was Māori and why she would want to believe that so badly?
Why does she want to believe that so badly?
Because her brother is Māori and she's been told by her mum that she is.
Right. Now you've since that 10-minute one woman show, you've added some layers to the story, right? There's a plot now. Do you want us to sort of kick off a little bit about the plot so people have an idea about that? Hard to do without spoilers.
It is hard to do without telling you the ending. It's top secret.
Okay, well, yeah, Curtis, maybe do you have any? It's tricky, this business talking about your films.
Did you talk about wanting to go to Surfers to see the dad? That's pretty much as far as we can go.
her brother goes down to Papamoa to pick kiwi fruit and sort of falls in with the wrong crowd, and she's trying to get him back from there so they can go.
Yeah.
At the same time, dealing with her boss about to get fired by the regional manager, who is also a love interest.
See, there's layers. There's so many layers to this film. It isn't, you've definitely built out from that first 10 minutes. I always think it's absolutely amazing how many of those Toi Whakaari solo shows have taken on lives, you know, whether they have been expanded theatrically or they've been turned into to other things. They seem to be like among the richest source of material. Curtis, you must have done a solo show when you were at...
I did, yeah. I went to Toi Whakaari in 2000 and, I did a solo show based on a character, Stephen Hannon, who was one of the four survivors of Cave Creek. And I didn't develop it after that, out of respect to Stephen. I directed a theatre show for Danny Mason straight after I left drama school. So I did a bit of directing then so many of the shows get developed. And
Matariki is from a solo piece, I think.
Yeah. Now, this is an escalator film and one of the few escalator films to have actually sort of made it to the screen so we can look at it. And yours looks like it would have been quite a difficult film to shoot. Like it's, 80%, 90% at night, which is very testing on crews, very testing on you, and very and also probably more expensive than shooting in the day as well. Tell us a little bit about how you actually got the film made.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that you kind of think that it would be more difficult because we, I guess when we applied, we thought of everything that would be possible to make it for $250,000, which is what we got from the escalator funding. So it's only a core cast of four, and I think it's an advantage that 80% of it was shot in the petrol station. In Sophie's original story, 100% of it was in a petrol station, so anything outside the petrol station was done through phone calls or postcards in terms of communication. So I guess the other 20% is shot down in Papamoa and a few little locations like Rainbow's End and stuff like that. We shot at night in a working petrol station, and we managed to get that for a real cheap price, basically.
We couldn't have done it without finding that working petrol station. And a lot of petrol stations are open really late as well, so we had to find one that closed early enough for us to get in there.
Exactly. So it was just an Indian owner-operator of one of those GAS petrol stations.
Umesh.
Called Umesh. And he'd lock up at about 6 o'clock. We'd pack in. Our department would set everything up, put all the... We changed the logo to Horizon. And had to cover all the orange and so that there was no sign of it being a GAS station. And then we'd start shooting at about 7 and then finish at about 3, 4 in the morning most of the time. Sometimes we'd go later, get up at midday and do it again for, I think, 16 days in a row. The shoot entirely was 20 days.
I've done night work. I've done overnight work, and I know that it can be really punishing. And I've talked to people who've worked on film crews, and you know that it really does take it out of you. How did you? And you chose to just go straight through with no breaks.
We did. We worked on a system. Our first AD set it up called French hours. I'd never really heard of it before, but it basically involves not really needing a dinner break at kind of 1 a.m. because that always feels strange. So people would arrive. There'd be a table of food and we'd eat and then have just a short little break so that we could kind of keep the momentum, but it was a 9-hour working day rather than a standard 10 that New Zealand tend to do. I've just spent the last 34 hours finishing the film off over the last couple of days, so I know what it's like.
What?
I've had 2 hours sleep, so that's why I probably seem a little bit strange. So just when you mentioned the... the night shoots, yeah. We've gone right through into day just to finish it, so it's being turned into a DCP as we speak.
So the ink will still be wet, effectively, when it screens.
It will, yeah. I think they hit the export button at about 1 p.m., so it should have finished.
It's like a 48-hour film. You're gonna be, there's going to be an audience sitting. Which theatre are you screening in here in Auckland?
Sky City.
At Sky City, there'll be an audience sitting at Sky City, and somebody will be sitting there watching the render bar.
I hope not.
Imagine.
One of the things that I found really really nice about your film was that it seems like one of those rare New Zealand films where everybody in it's been cast against type. And you know, like I used to work with Stephen Lovett, for example, back in Wellington Theatre in the early days, and you know, I see him on the screen playing sort of hard asses so often, and yet in this film he's really sweet. And you know, was that something that you decided consciously as an actor that you want that you would like to be seen that way as somebody who can stretch out? Sophie, is that something that you were thinking about?
For my own part that I wrote myself, yes. I played a lot of sort of objectified female characters, and so I wanted to write something for myself that was the opposite of that. Yeah.
And also, New Zealand actors are often typecast, and I mean, using Stephen Lovett as an example, as a person, he's an extremely lovable, fun character as well. You know, he's a nice guy. And so I see it like he was playing more himself. And we were looking for someone who could kind of be a bit grumpy but also lovable. So he, in my eyes, fit the brief perfectly.
You're playing some screenings here at the Auckland branch of the New Zealand International Film Festival. There are some screenings in Wellington. Do you have plans for the film after that, or are you waiting to see what happens?
We want to send it off to other festivals after we launch it at the New Zealand Festival. I'm off to Melbourne tomorrow. The film Fantail is part of the breakthrough screenings at 37 degrees South. So we'll be looking for sales, international sales agents and distributors over there, which is a whole new kind of world for me to kind of explore. It's all pretty new for me. So yeah, and then I guess, yeah, festivals, and then try and get a release when we get a distributor on board.
And Sophie, I know that with Escalator, the Film Commission like you to have not just one idea but a portfolio of ideas. What else have you got in the bottom drawer? Are you keen to get cracking again on the next one?
Yeah, I have a film in development with the Film Commission called Manhunt, which is about a woman who makes her own boyfriends out of household objects. So she she sculpts one, grows one, folds one and knits one.
I can't wait for that. Sophie Henderson and Curtis Vale from Fantail, thanks very much for being on Cinematica. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thanks for having us.
It's been our pleasure.
Round of applause for
thank you.
Thanks very much.
Then I found out about the first transit ever recorded. It was in 1639, and the astronomer who predicted and observed it was called Jeremiah Horrocks. Now that was a coincidence. Another Horrocks. Could we be related? I kind of hoped so. Jeremiah was quite a whiz kid, a 20-year-old amateur astronomer in the north of England. I learned that he had a crater on the moon named after him, and that he championed science when the term science hadn't even been invented yet. People still relied on magic, alchemy, and astrology. Much is written about Jeremiah, yet there's still a lot of mystery surrounding him. I'm starting to get obsessed with discovering the real Jeremiah, and can I really be connected to him?
Shirley Horrocks, welcome to Cinematica. You're here to talk about Venus, A Quest, your documentary. And I watched this very recently and was fascinated to see you've got to scroll down the credits quite a long way before you find somebody who isn't called Horrocks in this film. It's a real family affair. Tell us a bit about the film and how it came to be made and in the festival.
Right. Well, the voice that you heard was Dylan Horrocks, who's my stepson. And people might know Dylan, who's quite a well-known cartoonist, and he wrote a book called Hicksville. And he actually fronted for me in a documentary I made about the comics industry in New Zealand. So I knew that he was really good on camera. And we had a lot of fun. And how the film came about? Well, Venus featured in the news last year because there was a transit of Venus. So that was one thing, and it was kind of a family myth that this guy, Jeremiah Horrocks, could be connected. My husband, Roger, had been a keen astronomer when he was a teenager, and he was aware of Jeremiah and the crater on the moon. So there was that story. So
and Jeremiah Horrocks was the first person to actually identify what was going on, that it was Venus travelling across the face of the sun, and not just that, but to use that to measure and do calculations on the distance of the sun from the earth, etc. And I mean, he really was the first modern astronomer in many ways. So you'd want to claim him, wouldn't you, really?
Absolutely.
For the family.
But you'll have to see the film to see if we are in fact allowed to claim him.
But what's interesting about the film is that, like, it starts off as if it's going to be one of those, you know, where have I come from documentaries where, you know, the family tree is going to be investigated. But then it goes off into some very interesting directions in terms of the lessons that Dylan learns based on the stories that he finds out about Jeremiah, about Captain Cook, about the you know, his arrival in New Zealand. Tell us a little bit about that, because you do go off in some very on some very interesting tangents.
That's right. Well, it's really rather like throwing a pebble into the water and then all the ripples come out. And there were various strands that run through the film, and they really are all connected to this: who are we, where are we going, where do we come from? But it broadens out from being Dylan wanting to know, is he related to Jeremiah Horrocks? And it really does become a sort of universal, a quest that has a universal theme, like where have we all come from?
And where are we going?
And where are we going?
Yeah, because you delve into nanotechnology and the future of science. It's about curiosity, isn't it, as much as anything else? It's like, you know, what do you do with those questions when you have them? You could just sit and ponder, or you can go and do some work, can't you? Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the making of the film. How long did it take to actually put together? And I know that one of the things that's a little bit noticeable about the film is that there are a couple of faces in there that have since passed away. And so, you know, the Transit of Venus was last year. Just tell us a little bit about the production side of it.
Yes. Well, the very first interview I did was with the late Sir Paul Callaghan. And we knew we had to do that that interview then, because we weren't sure how long he was going to be with us. And sadly, he did. Die before the film was shown, and the film is dedicated to him. But what a wonderful man, and to have his support was fantastic.
How can people see your film? You've got some screenings here in Auckland in the New Zealand International Film Festival. Where are you playing?
At the Academy on Sunday, this coming Sunday at 12:15, and then the following Thursday at 2:30, and then in Wellington at Te Papa on August the 11th at 1 p.m.
Well, I can thoroughly recommend it to people, because I found it a fascinating and really winning documentary. Shirley Horrocks, thanks very much for being on Cinematica.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the incredibly strange Mr. Ant Timpson. Do you ever get tired of that introduction?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it sums everything up pretty easily.
There's a question I wanted to ask you, because the news broke this afternoon about Maniac and the rating for it, the fact that it's only been rated for festivals and education.
And it's been banned and from New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, banned is such a incendiary word. I wouldn't necessarily say it's been banned, but it's
restricted
effectively
heavily.
Been kind of banned. I mean, it's been restricted to festival screenings only, and for educational purposes, they always include that in the rider for films that are under that sort of category. So it's a very rare classification that comes up now and then. It's the RFF rating. For film festivals only. And yeah, so I haven't even had a chance to actually thoroughly go through the report on Maniac to find out exactly why the OFLC has decided to restrict it. I've got some pretty good guess why that's happened, but I think what could happen is that maybe a discussion could come out of it, which would be really good, because
It's a very interesting film
because it's the point of view aspect of the film which is what's causing a big palaver. And the first person nature of it mixed with, you know, the lurid nature of the film, which is a remake of a 1980s slasher film. This has got Elijah Wood. It's very obviously a piece of fiction. And so I'm very curious to see how this opens up a line of dialogue about, you know, censorship in New Zealand in this day and age, especially with what's available at a click of a button.
Well, exactly. Things have changed a lot since we were working on the Incredibly Strange Film Festival, and I was talking to Kaylee a little bit earlier on before we came to air about remembering Irreversible in the Incredibly Strange and you know, that got an identical classification, I think, wasn't it? It was festival screenings and education, and we sold a lot of tickets on the basis of that for that one screening.
Yeah, you know, it's like a red flag to a bull, really.
Yeah.
And I guess this is going to happen. I mean, I'm sure the distributor will want to make as much noise as possible to drive that aspect of it. But it's also, from their point of view, I guess it's just a financial necessity that, you know, it's the only outlet now for the film to make some revenue for what they paid for the movie for Australasia. So they might appeal that decision. I'm not too sure what the process, what they've got planned. But for us, I guess it's a way for people maybe now to come and see the film to see, you know,
what the huzzah is about.
Yeah, what it's all about, and also where that line has now maybe shifted. Because the whole the way that the office works is that it has to be injurious, supposedly injurious to the public good. And so they are saying that there is a potential for this, for Maniac to be injurious to the public at large. What I want to sort of, I mean, if you take the sexual aspect of Maniac out of it, the idea that people are being, can go into an immersive environment as such as a first-person point of view, then it sort of opens up that whole dialogue about video games and the aspect of first-person shooters, and that's a really slippery slope once you go down that aspect. But, you know, coming back to it, it's like Maniac has been released around the world. If people want to see it, it's very easy. Yeah, and it's like, it's kind of strange that it's restricted to festivals. It's kind of saying that everyone who comes to the festival is absolutely normal. You know, and it's those other people in those suburban areas who are watching it on video that you have to really worry about. So it's kind of, there's a weird sort of classist thing going on.
Totally. But, you know, it is in the festival. How are people going to be able to see it legitimately?
That at the moment, that's the only way legally that you are allowed. I mean, if, I guess I'm not too sure what the fining is if you did decide to rent the film or to, you know, to advertise it publicly. Outside of that, I'm sure you'll be breaking the law as it is at the moment.
How many screenings do you have?
We're going to have a lot more now, I'm sure. But,
extra screenings.
Yeah, no, I think it's. I think nothing's changing. I guess, you know, that's up to the festival themselves to how it's going to play out. But I'm sure if it's, you know, there's enough brouhaha about it, it's going to drive people to want to see the film, which is the flip side to the whole thing, is like, you know, why?
Yeah. All right. I'm just going to play a little bit of audio to introduce you, sir.
Okay.
All right.
You're right.
You all good?
You know what you need? You need to get a little intoxicated with a buddy of yours, you know, get a little crazy.
No, I gotta go home.
Catch some fish with this.
Just come home.
All right, I will hang out for just a little bit.
Yes!
It's always a good time when you're giggling at your own trailer. You're like,
Without the visuals, I'm just wondering what people are processing.
I know. Can I just say, I've been cutting trailer audio for this show for 2 years, and that was the most difficult thing I've ever had to deal with. It's a fantastic trailer, but it's boy, it's challenging. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I know that EL Katz, we've got you here. You're a guest of the festival. It's a pleasure to have you on Cinematica. Tell us a bit about your film, Cheap Thrills, because this is coming out of left field for me, I have to say. So,
cool. I think that's the best way probably to experience it. So I think I'm going to temper some of the spoilers, but essentially, you know, it starts off as, it could feel like just a drama about a guy that, you know, needs to support his family and gets fired from his job, and, you know, he just kind of avoids going home and telling his wife about how dire things are. He goes to a bar and runs into an old friend who's a bit of trouble, and the two meet a rich couple that just starts saying, hey, let's party, let's have a good time, don't worry about any of your shit, you know, let's just drink some beer and drink some expensive tequila and do some blow and, you know, have some fun, and things start to spiral out of control, and the genre itself starts to change and shift, and it kind of lands in a very different place than it starts. But
where did the idea come from?
Well, initially I found the script by a writer, Trent Haga, who, he had a film called Dead Girl, and he used to work for Troma, who, you know, also have a lot of crazy subversive shit. You know, I used to work for them back in the day too when I was really young. They were like one of my first break-ins. I worked for their short-lived website, tromaville.com, which I think they lost quite a bit of money on. Not because of me, hopefully, but... So he, you know, I used to have a dinner where I'd invite, you know, 40, 50 horror screenwriters together, and we'd just sit around and complain about how little money we were making. And at some point I decided, you know, I'm sick of seeing other people screw up the stuff that I write, or, you know, take credit when I do a good job or whatever. And I was like, I just want to do something, you know, even if it's like really low budget. And I asked all these guys if they had anything that could be done on the cheap. And Trent gave me the script that initially he, you know, was going out to go to market with it. You know, he thought it was a commercial concept. And this was going to be more of like a mainstream kind of project. And his representation were like, you're crazy. Like, this is not going to sell at all. You should put this away. So he took it out of the drawer and gave it to me. And I just really loved the concept. I thought it was so charged. And, you know, there's just a lot of room to play with it. You know, and you could do it for cheap because it was just people basically in one room. So I said, hey, let's do it.
And what sort of response have you had to the film?
It's been really good.
Well, Ant's picked it up. That's always a good sign. Ant, where did you see it?
I saw it South by Southwest this year, and it won the jury audience prize.
Yeah,
which is, I think, the best prize to win, really, because critics don't know what they're talking about. So, if you can win the audience over, I think you're on your way to a successful career. And Evan's got a history with another filmmaker I'm good friends with, Adam Woodgard, who's got a film in the festival this year called You're Next as well, and they've collaborated on many, many projects. And Cheap Thrills was definitely one of the most buzzed titles of South By this year.
And I'd met Ant, you know, more than 10 years ago when I was staying in a hostel in Fantasia Fest, and I had like a really, really cruddy gore movie that I'd made with Adam that I was showing everybody a trailer on my laptop that probably even had a weirder trailer. And I'm surprised that he didn't just go, all right, cool, kid, goodbye forever. But, you know, it's cool.
Yeah. Is this your first visit to New Zealand?
Yes. This is one of my first trips out of the country. So there's a lot of first.
This film's here. Really opening doors.
Yeah, there's been a lot of traveling the past 2 months. Like, I came here from South Korea, so I'm like still kind of jet lagged and processing.
All right. Kaylee, have you got some questions?
I'm just impressed you work for Troma. It's like mad props, man. Mad props. Because a funny story, I'm totally going to segue. But there was this security guard at my university who's a little bit weird. And then for the Halloween party that we have every year, because you go to art school, there's like epic Halloween parties. We were playing one of the Troma films about the nerdy kid who falls into like the goo and then becomes an alien, or becomes like a super guy.
Toxie, yeah.
Yes, yes. The security guard came up to me because I was working projection. He's like, oh, I love Troma. Did you know they have this website? And I have like all their DVDs. And he became this legendary guy. So that's awesome.
Well, they paid me in movies. So they paid that's me in great. VHS tapes.
Wow. Yeah. Awesome. But yeah, I don't have my ticket yet to Cheap Thrills, but I'm definitely looking forward to it. Because reading the synopsis, it sounds like a very elaborate and disturbing game of truth or dare that escalates
basically,
very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say that's sort of what it is.
Yeah. You've got some well-known faces, or reasonably well-known faces in your film, and yet you mentioned earlier on that you could do it for cheap. So people like David Koechner, is that what I'm pronouncing his name?
Yeah, Koechner.
Koechner.
Yeah.
So was he won over by the script, or
they all did it for nothing? Like, they got paid shit. You know, the budget was really, really small. It was like $100,000.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
that's why I want every young filmmaker to check this film out, because if you really want something that can show how to have a film that really connects with an audience just purely through script and character development, it's a great film to see and to know that I knew it was low. I didn't realize it was that low. Oh, that's crazy.
Hopefully I haven't spoken out of turn, but I'm in New Zealand, so none of my American producers can hear me, maybe.
Are you coming to Wellington with the film, or are you just...
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, look forward to Kaylee and I are based in Wellington. We've just come up for today to do the show. So looking forward to seeing your film and to seeing you introduce it and being there for the reaction as well.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
Sunday night in Wellington. It's a real pleasure. EL Katz, Evan, is that right? Yes. Excellent. Welcome. Thanks very much for being on Cinematica. It's been a real pleasure having you here. Thanks very much, Ant, for your time. I know that our booking for this venue expires very shortly, and also there were bells going upstairs and people wanting to get to other films. It's been an absolute pleasure to be here at the Winter Garden for this first ever live in front of an audience performance, if you like, of Cinematica. We're going to play you out with, especially for Rudy, this is some more Liberace.
We reviewed Behind the Candelabra a little bit earlier on.
And that is our show for this week. Next week, the Cinematica tour continues. We're going back to our hometown. We're going to be recording the show in front of a Wellington audience at the Paramount Theatre. That's at 5:15 p.m. on Wednesday, the 31st of July, where there'll be more special guests, more special features, and Simon's going to be back for that one. All of that and more, next week's exciting episode of Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software. That's the way that every episode is always downloaded automatically, and also you can give us feedback in the iTunes store, ratings, reviews, etc. They all help other people find and discover the show. And you can contact us. Kaylee, you are our social media manager.
Yes, and just to prove I have it memorized, watch this. So you can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can read our two-word reviews, and as always, on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with this lovely piece of Liberace just for Rudy. Once again, we'd like to thank all of our guests, Rudy Tavares, Curtis Vowell and Sophie Henderson from Fantail, Shirley Horrocks from Venus, Steve and Liam from Flix, who were most excellent, Ant Timpson and Evan here as well, and special thanks to Rory from The Edge, who was keeping our sound all nice and balanced. First time we've actually had an external engineer on the show. We should keep that happening.
Let's take you're coming to Wellington.
And that is it for this week. That's all from me.
That's all from me.